the Army should buy. He's now a private consultant, and one of his clients now is General Dynamics Land Systems Division, which is directly bidding on the ground combat vehicle program. That he was brought to the National Defense University to advise on. And it gets to my earlier point. I have no reason to believe that General Wallace was, you know, untruthful in his ethics questionnaire. So when the question came up, do you have any plans or intention to consult for a company in the future that might have a stake in this program, it really doesn't matter what he said, whether he said yes or no, because obviously, in the end, it really didn't matter, because he soon thereafter went to work for General Dynamics Land Systems. And, you know, General Wallace and others I talked to will say, well, we signed a non-disclosure agreement before we went to this meeting. So, you know, we promised that whatever we learn here, whatever we find out, whatever this meeting is about, we will not share that with anyone else. But that gets to this other issue, which some others raised, which is the policing mechanism basically is inside the brain of the general or admiral. As one put it, you have to have a firewall in your head. So you know some inside information, perhaps, that you got from a meeting like this or a variety of others in the Pentagon. But when you go to the boardroom or when you go meet with your client, you basically have to make sure that you don't download from one side of your brain to the other the information that you learned that you're not supposed to share with your client. And I think many will say that that's a minefield that is very difficult to walk. And that's why many people think that the generals shouldn't be in that position to begin with. And maybe one point I'll make, which is sort of a broader point. Even the most concerned critics of this phenomenon and how it's grown, no one will say that, oh, the generals should just retire and go off to the golf course and sit in their rocking chair and smoke a corncob pipe. You know, many of them retire at 55. They're in great health. They've spent an enormous amount of years in the military. They certainly have an expertise that is valued. Everyone agrees that they're going to go do something like in any other industry, which is their expertise. Where the real concern is again, the blurring of the lines. No one's saying they shouldn't go work for defense companies, but they probably shouldn't be also, in so many cases, advising the Pentagon on some of the very same issues that they're working on in the private sector.
Brian, I want to—
And that particularly goes for the consulting arena.
I want to go to a related issue. David Barstow, the twice Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter, who exposed how dozens of retired generals working as radio and television analysts have been co-opted by the Pentagon to make its case for the war in Iraq, and how many of them also had undisclosed ties to military contractors that benefited from policies they defended. This is David Barstow on Democracy Now! In May of 2009, explaining how Pentagon officials developed this program during the lead-up to the Iraq War.
The way to really influence the American public was to try to find people who were viewed as independent of both government and the media, people who were considered authoritative and expert, people who would have an ability to cut through the spin. And the group that they began zeroing in on were all the military analysts who were being hired in droves after 9/11 by all the major TV networks. In the view of Tori Clark and her staff, these guys were sort of the ultimate key influencers. They were seen as most of them retired decorated war heroes. There were many of them retired generals, some 3- and 4-star generals. They came from an institution that traditionally is extremely trusted by the American public. And they were seen by the public not really as of the media, but not of the government either. And so in the fall of 2002, Tori Clark and her aides, and with the strong support from the White House and from her bosses, set out to target this group and to make them really one of the main vehicles for reaching the American public and building support from the war on terror. And so that's how it sort of began, was with this idea that they could take this thing called the military analysts, which is a creature that's been around for a long time, going back to the first Gulf War. We remember some of the retired generals first coming on air. And they could take this and the fact of 9/11 and the fact of how prevalent they were on air, sometimes appearing, you know, segment after segment after segment, getting more airtime than many correspondents were getting, holding forth on, not just on the issues of, you know, where the airplanes are flying and where the tanks are moving, but weighing, you know, more heavily on even the strategic issues of what should we do next and how should the war on terror unfold, what should be the next targets. And they looked at them as effectively what they were doing was writing the op-ed on air for the networks and for the cables. And they noticed the way the relationships between the anchors and their sort of in-house generals, there was a sort of bond between anchor and general, and you didn't see the kind of challenging questioning that would go on if you had sent, for example, a representative of the Pentagon to the TV station. It was a much more almost fawning, in some cases, a kind of relationship between anchor and general. So they saw this group, and they saw in this group a way of taking the media filter, which politicians are always so fond of complaining about, and turning the media filter into more of a media megaphone.
That's the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter David Barstow and his expose last year. Brian Bender, you're the national security reporter for the Boston Globe. Your final comment on this, as you talk about the generals who become military contractors, in the media, they are rarely identified as such, simply as a retired general, even when they're pushing for some weapons system that their corporation will benefit from.
Well, I think David's segment gets to this point of real angst that is growing within the military, and that is that the retired generals are sort of the moral exemplars of all the people coming up the ranks behind them. And if there is even the appearance of this conflict of interest, an appearance that they're doing something behind the scenes that they don't want public, they don't want disclosed, that has repercussions for the military. And there's not a whole lot of voices in the military that are saying that publicly just yet. There certainly are some retired generals who've told me about it. And again, I think it gets to the broader issue of what this trend means to the health of the officer corps. If everyone sees this conveyor belt that goes from the Pentagon to the private defense world, and a lot of it is not very public and it's not very transparent, the big question that some of them have is, does this erode what traditionally it's meant to be an officer in the United States?
Brian Bender, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll link to your piece at the Boston Globe, and that does it for our broadcast. Renowned physician and human rights activist Dr. Binayak Sen has been sentenced to life in prison in India. Amnesty International calls him a prisoner of conscience. We'll post our interview with him at democracynow.org. Don't miss it. Thanks to the whole staff who came in today. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph, your community station.
The Albion is turning 155 years old in 2011 and is pleased to include CFRU in the celebration. Holding the second oldest liquor license in Ontario, the Albion is one of Guelph's finest and most long-standing establishments. Come to Fresh Friday's special anniversary fundraising party to benefit CFRU on January 21st from 10 p.m. till 2 a.m. Songs to make you sing and dance with hits from the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. This is a part of the Albion's anniversary celebration taking place all weekend long with giveaways and samples from our regular and winter feature menu. The Albion is located downtown at the corner of Macdonnell and Norfolk. Check out www.thealbionhotel.ca for more details on the rest of the weekend.
Get juiced.
Refreshing smoothies.
Get juice.
Mouth-watering paninis.
Get juice.
Savory soup.
Get juice.
Gourmet coffee.
Get juice.
Scrumptious desserts.
Get juice.
Free Wi-Fi.
Get juice.
Freshly squeezed juice.
Get juiced.
Chill atmosphere.
Get juiced.
Friendly staff.
Get juiced.
Cozy chairs.
Get juiced.
Free bike parking.
Get juiced.
Funky restrooms.
Get juiced.
Clean floors.
Get juiced.
Solid tables.
Get juiced. 113 McDonnell Street, downtown Guelph. Across from the Greyhound bus terminal.
Freak Scene is named after this song by Dinosaur Jr., which probably more than anything gives you a good idea of what you're going to hear. Plenty of hard-hitting alternative. Not to be limited to just that, though. You'll hear everything that rocks. Things might even get mellow every once in a while. You just never know. Check it out Monday nights from 8 to 10 here on CFRU.
Immigrant Services Guelph, Wellington offer free settlement and adoption services for a new immigrant to Canada. We are committed to providing programs and services that ease the transition that immigrants face as they settle into their new home. Clients are assisted through confidential and culturally sensitive counseling. We offer free settlement services in the following languages: Arabic, Cantonese, Mandarin, Dari, Hungarian, English, Farsi, French, Pashto, Serbian, Spanish, Urdu, Hindi, Punjabi, and Vietnamese. You can contact Immigrant Services, Guelph Wellington, for more information about our free settlement services as well as all our other programs at 519-836-2222. That's 519-836-2222. Drop by and see us at 926 Paisley Road. You can also visit us on our website www.is-gw.ca. Thank you.
Hello, you're tuned into Terra Informa, your weekly source for environmental news from across Canada and around the globe. My name is Anna McLeod, and I will be your host for the next 30 minutes. This week, we have Miles talking with NDP MP Linda Duncan, discussing her experiences at a climate conference in Cancun. In our second segment, we will be airing part two of Dr. David Schindler's talk on measuring the effects of oil sands development on the Athabasca River. But first, here's Sana with the news.
On December 10th, CBC News reported the study of wildfires and climate change. According to Mary Tursky, increasing temperature causes more wildfires. Greenhouse gas emissions are increasing from the wildfire, and this phenomenon occurs not only in Alaska but in Canada. In 2004, there was 52 million tons of carbon dioxide released from the Alaskan wildfires only in 3 to 4 months. Mary Tursky, an ecology professor at the University of Guelph, she said that's equivalent to the amount of carbon released by all domestic airline flights in the United States for the entire year. Unfortunately, similar patterns occur in Canada, and since Canada has warmer climate than in Alaska, the possibility of fires is higher. A warmer climate causes ecosystem to dry, making the ecosystem weak on wildfires. As a global issue, climate changes from the wildfire is not the end of the problems. It can damage people's lives living in the north. Only a small degree of increasing temperature in decades causes to decrease the amount of snow cover, and it affects to resource developments like diamond and oil, and it also affects to people's recreational activities. Leah Bendel, a biologist in Simon Fraser University, insists that Health Canada has to enhance the guideline of proper amount of consumption of shellfish. She says the amount of cadmium in oysters, scallops, and mussels harvested in coast BC is 2 to 10 times higher than in any other city in the world. Bendel says consumers need to know exactly how much shellfish they can safely eat to ensure that long-term exposure to cadmium doesn't jeopardize their health. CFIA, Canada Food Inspection Agency, reported that exposure to cadmium for a long time can occur to kidney damage, and Health Canada found that cadmium levels in oysters in BC were higher than other seafood. They recommend eating 460 grams or 12 oysters in a month is enough for adults, and 1.5 is enough for children. However, opposite to Leah Bendel saying, Guy Dean, vice president of Albion Fisheries in Vancouver, insists that their seafood industry has been disturbed from the kind of guidelines. He said because of the people who want zero tolerance in cadmium into their marketplace, so they have been restricted in where they send their products. The guideline about consuming shellfish in Europe says one oyster in a week is enough, and three oysters in a week is enough, according to the United Nations and World Health Organization. According to the CBC News on December 10th, Saskatchewan's power company is waiting for decision and emissions regulations from the federal government for a clean coal project. They will rebuild the old integrated carbon capture and storage facility at the coal-fired Boundary Dam power plant near Estevan, Saskatchewan. Robert Watson, the president of Sask Power, said they need to get some clarification and certainty of what the federal government are going to do. To minimize the climate change, the federal conservative government has spent hundreds of millions of dollars for a clean coal project. Per capita, Saskatchewan is the largest emitter of greenhouse gas from burning coal to generate electricity in the country. The company says they would spend $1.2 billion to rebuild Boundary Dam 3 as an integrated carbon capture and storage unit, but they could spend $354 million if they refurbished the 40-year-old unit to use 30 years more. And they expect that it will be the latest developed carbon capture setting.
Thanks, Sanaa. I'm Anna McLeod, your host this week on Terra Informa. If you'd like to check out any of our previous episodes, or re-listen to this one, you can find them all on terrainforma.ca. The Cancun climate talks wrapped up with a late-night agreement after a week which left most skeptical about the possibilities for international cooperation at the UN level. In an effort to gain a deeper insight into the process and outcome of the Cancun negotiations, Terra Informa correspondent Miles Curry interviewed both environmental activist Russell Charlton as well as NDP MP Linda Duncan as they left Cancun from two different international conferences on climate change. Now, here's Miles speaking with New Democrat environment critic and Member of Parliament for Edmonton Strathcona, Linda Duncan, the morning after the conclusion of the Cancun conference.
We're doing this interview on Saturday morning. I mean, there was lots of late night conference, 11th hour stuff happening last night. What came out of those negotiations? What is sort of the state of the Cancun conference right now?
Well, I have to share with you that I think this was expressed resoundingly by practically every delegate who spoke late last night, that the reason why there was success in reaching a final agreement, even though it's not a legally binding, what people were really excited about and gave absolute kudos and applause, endless applause, to the Mexican official who was the president and led the discussion, was because this time around, unlike Copenhagen, she insisted the process remain open and transparent and inclusive. So, as she said, all the doors were always open and all the parties were part of it, unlike at Copenhagen, where in the end, you may recall, that it was just a select number of countries that were pulled together that cut a deal. So I think that if I take any strong message out of what came out of Cancun was that it was achieved because they followed the important principles of openness and transparency.
Interesting. So how did that openness and transparency actually change what was the result of the negotiations? What's the difference
between... Well, from what the delegates from a wide array of countries were saying is that it built the trust of it again. That at this process, I mean, going out of Copenhagen, people were very disillusioned, particularly from the lesser developed nations, because they felt that they'd been excluded and made irrelevant. and that it was only the big G8 type nations that counted. And so it was up to Mexico to try to turn that around here at Cancun, and to their credit, they absolutely achieved that. So I guess the message out of this that I'm going to be taking back as the New Democrat environment critic to the government of Canada is, okay, lessons learned here. Let's reverse course. Let's start making more open and transparent and inclusive the policy-making decisions of this government, and let's bring everybody to the table. There was still a lot of contention here. The youth delegation particularly upset that they were excluded from the process.
So speaking, maybe something that a little less positive, what was the Conservative government's position coming into and at these negotiations? And how did that largely contribute to the end result of this conference? There was a lot
Well, they, of course, were digging in their heels. They didn't want to have the Kyoto mechanism continued over into 2012. And, of course, Canada is one of the countries that ratified Kyoto and is bound by targets, which a lot of us think were reasonable if we hadn't dragged our feet for almost 20 years. So they clearly did not want to be bound by those Kyoto targets and didn't necessarily want to carry forward the provisions of that agreement. But it's my understanding, and I haven't been able to read all the fine print yet, my understanding as the decision was is that those mechanisms will be carried forward. So that was a real victory, I think, for the environment and for the lesser developed countries. Because under the agreement that we're still operating under right now, the major emitters were legally bound to reduce their emissions and to provide resources to the developing nations. So they were worried that if we didn't carry forward those mechanisms under that agreement, that they wouldn't have those commitments. So a lot of those commitments are included in this agreement. Even though this agreement isn't legally binding, the countries have committed to a number of actions, including the transfer of technology and the transfer of resources for the countries to adapt. Of course, as Tuvalu said at Copenhagen and is repeating here, all the money in the world is not going to help their country if they're underwater. Mm-hmm. So, the thing to watch for over the next year is the progress being made on the binding targets. President Morales of Bolivia was one of the few minority who spoke against signing off on this agreement. And the strongest argument I heard from him is because the targets of Copenhagen are still going to mean that we're going to have climate catastrophe.
We're above 40 degrees.
So he felt that, that they wanted to still hang on to that bargaining chip to force the major emitters to reduce. But in the end, the vast majority of nations, almost all of them, were in consensus that they felt that they got a lot out of these negotiations and they wanted to sign off on the agreement, and they did.
Well, that's great.
Where is Canada in this?
Yeah.
I guess that's what we'll watch for. I'll tell you one thing I'm really excited about. Last night in the wee hours of the morning, while we were listening to the endless speeches, I started going through the agreement, and I was excited to see that in the agreement Canada has signed, we have agreed that we will deliver on a clean energy strategy for Canada. And I and my colleagues have been mounting a campaign for that to happen ever since I was elected. So that's a strong message and a campaign I'm going to be taking back, and I'm hoping I can get a lot of your listeners on board to be putting the heat on Canada to, in fact, kickstart Canadian clean energy sustainability strategy and through a process that is open, transparent, and inclusive.
Yeah. So where do you see the momentum maybe coming out of this going to into Durban? Is there going, like, last year it was really about there was Cochabamba right after Copenhagen Accord, where a lot of climate justice movement really gained traction and really started helping to support the developing countries. Where do you see the movement kind of moving out from this? Is there going to be sort of more cooperation? Is this multilateralism the new ethic that's going to sort of pervade the climate movement into the next year?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, the really neat thing is I met this wonderful woman from Reuters news service, and she actually maintains a separate website on climate alert. And I'll be posting that on my website so people can follow. And the neat thing about that is she spent the entire conference, unlike her colleagues, not going to the government wrangling and negotiation. She spent all the time at the side events. And, you know, people need to understand that these quote-unquote side events are actually an integral part of what's going forward. And at these series of international meetings that have occurred, there have been people that have come from state and provincial and municipal governments and First Nations and United Nations organizations, business and institutes and universities. And it's unbelievable the initiatives that have been forged through these meetings and are being kickstarted. And just an amazing array of innovative projects that are already happening on the ground. So essentially, the second message that I've taken out of this meeting is, people are not sitting and waiting for the government. Mm-hmm. They're already doing it. They're already trying to take action.
We've talked to you a lot about the Climate Accountability Act and Bill C-311, which was squashed in the Senate. So, you know, to the outrage of environmentalists and most Canadians, how can Canada's position have changed if that was law? Like, how would that change how we negotiate internationally?
To tell you the truth, I mean, that bill is very important. And it was important for two reasons. One, it would have committed Canada to the science-based targets. And from what we're hearing from the scientific community, those targets aren't even deep enough. So that's the important thing. That's the message we need to be getting out in saying that Canada has not committed enough. We need to do a bigger part. And the other part is accountability of the government. Now, interestingly, my bill, the Canadian Environmental Bill of Rights, is before committee now. And the last days of debate on that will be happening this Monday and Wednesday. And the reason why the timing is so perfect is the whole purpose and intent of my Canadian Environmental Bill of Rights is to give the public the legal right to participate in these kinds of negotiations. To me, the most important thing is that whatever policies we come forward on, whether they're energy, whether they're development, whether they're environment, they need to be grounded in what Canadians want, not just the small sector of fossil fuel companies.
Great. We'll definitely put a link up to that, and we'll keep our listeners posted on the development of those bills. Thank you very much, Linda. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, great to talk to you. Love your station.
Thank you, Miles. Tune in next week to hear Miles interview Russell Charlton about his experiences at the Alternative Conferences on Climate Justice and Respect for Mother Earth in Cancun. For those of you just tuning in, this is Terra Informa, your source for Canadian and global environmental news. We are heard across the country on stations such as CKLB in Tuktoyaktuk and CKDU from Halifax. Last week, we aired part one in a two-part series brought to us by Terra Informa correspondent Rebecca Rooney. Back on December 3rd, she recorded a talk titled Measuring the Effects of Oil Sands Development on the Athabasca River Ecosystem, delivered by Dr. David Schindler. Dr. David Schindler is the Killam Memorial Professor of Ecology at the University of Alberta. His recent research has concluded that the oil sands extraction and upgrading north of Fort McMurray does contribute to the contaminant load of the Athabasca River. This research clearly demonstrates that contamination from oil sands extraction and upgrading can be detected up to the range of 50 kilometers away. In part one, he focused on the increase in toxic metals and hydrocarbons in the snowpack, in tributaries, and in the main Athabasca River, and the reasons why the data collected by Alberta Environment and by the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program has historically failed to detect this contamination. In part two, he focuses on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, often called PAHs, and associated deformities in fish. We pick up where Dr. Schindler left off, explaining how he was able to achieve more sensitive measurements of PAHs than Alberta Environment or RAMP using a new sampling technique.
This new technique that we used are called PEMDs for permeable membrane devices. They're contained in these little cylinders. They're just sections of aluminum pipe that have been sawed off about 4 inches long. And some screens put over them to protect the membrane, and the membrane is just wound on a little set of spindles within that. These were used in the Gulf of Alaska for about 16 or 17 years. They were well calibrated by NOAA and things. Under George Bush, they didn't have enough money to deploy them even, so we just borrowed them. and used them in the Athabasca River. We just hung a piece of chain on these to hold them on the bottom of the river, a rope and a stake through the ice so that they could be retrieved.